You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome, all you weirdos, hypno-conditioned sleeper agents, and that one mutant whose name I can't quite recall. It is time for your 96th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your Weird Science podcast family. I am your metaphysical etc. host, Jason, broadcasting now and forever, from the Wrong Turn studio, perched high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And joining me is a man who wields the awesome power of three podcasters, my pal Ruben. Hey Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Good, I'm sitting here in my chair today with inexplicable red hair, but I guess there might be an issue with my colorist, so...
Yeah, otherwise, we'll talk about that a little bit. It's confusing on purpose, and I think sometimes confusing by accident day in some of the books. So we'll definitely talk about that. So we will get to your origin story at some point where you got your power of three podcasters. I think it involves being bitten by a radioactive Eric Shea somewhere in the mix, but that's for another day. Today we're going to talk about three X-related comic books. The first one is Avengers number 13, which is the second and final part of that tie-in to the Fall of X story, and then Rise of the Powers of X number 4 and X-Men Forever number 2, both by Kieran Gillen, and both kind of say two halves of the same story. So those are a little more complicated. We're going to start off a little bit easy and go with Avengers number 13. Oh, and I should mention that, yeah, Wolverine number 48 also did come out this week, but we have a lot to talk about this week and not so much time to do it in, so we decided to punt Wolverine off to next week, just to make sure we didn't have to rush any of the more continuity complicated bits. Sound good?
Let's get into it.
Okay, Avengers number 13. Where is the ding sound? There it is. Avengers number 13, Hit Back Part 2. Written by Jed McKay, art by Francesco Moratrino, colors by Federico Blee, letters by Corey Pettit, design by Carlos Lau. So yes, this is the second final part of the Fall of the House of X tie-in. We get reminded again on the title page that this crossover takes place during the events of Fall of the House of X number 1. So from our point of view, it is kind of a good way back in the past. It's also a little bit strange as a tie-in, as the only character from the main event books who also appears in these tie-in issues is MODOK, who of course in the current continuity has already quit Orcus and moved on to his next thing. I guess unless you want to count Stark Sentinels or random Orcus goons as characters, but... you know, they're really more like set dressing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this was a good book. It was good on its own merits, and it also made the first issue better in retrospect, and I'll get to why and how about that in a moment. It's not nearly as ambitious as the other books we're going to talk about today, but on its own merits, I think it might be the most successful at just trying to accomplish what it set out to do. As you may recall, the first issue of this tie-in was all about the Avengers deciding to finally help out their mutant buddies by attacking various and sundry Orcus locations. And everything they did was completely successful, super easy, barely an inconvenience. Until, in the final panel, something happened that they never in a million years could have predicted. In return for the Avengers attacking Orcus bases, Orcus attacked the Avengers base. Now, this issue does justify their surprise a little bit more. We're told that the Avengers sentient base, aka the Impossible City, is supposed to have, quote, powerful stealth screens and alter its orbit regularly. Now yeah. Ruben, you've been reading Avengers, right?
I have, yeah.
So would regular Avengers readers have kind of known this about the city, and would that make them more surprised if the Sentinels were attacking?
They haven't covered the stealth screen concept, but this base was basically described as the carrier, except in the Marvel Universe. So okay. It had lots of cool capabilities, and it was the base of a bunch of super bads.
Okay, so like maybe regular Avengers readers would have taken that as more of a shock, where people just coming in like me for the event are like, well, duh, of course they're going to do that. So the Avengers do some more fighting this issue, and there's a bit about Captain Marvel trading places with a woman named Yuna in a way similar to how the old Captain Marvel would trade places with Rick Jones. But the real meat of the story is all about 3D Man, Delroy Garrett. And we talked about him last time. We were told that he has a grudge against the Avengers dating back to the post-Civil War Avengers Initiative days. Now, joining up with literally Orcus seemed like a pretty extreme manifestation of a simple grudge, but we went with it. And I was temporarily confused early on in this issue when the Avengers somehow knew that Delroy Garrett was the guy responsible for the attack on their base. Frankly, I thought it was a mistake. I thought, they shouldn't really know that, but they have to say that to make the story happen. No, I was wrong. It was good writing. It was foreshadowing, which maybe you don't expect these days, but that's what it
you
was.
You don't,
it was,
yeah. It was, I mean, it's fair to be skeptical, right? Just assume that it's poor writing to get from point A to point B.
It was done in a good way because it wasn't leaned on like, I'm foreshadowing here, like we often get. It was just T'Challa and I forget who else saying, oh yeah, what's Delroy up to? Why is he doing this? The reveal later in the issue is that Delroy has been a deep cover double agent all along. In fact, his cover is so deep that even he didn't know that he was working for the Avengers. A flashback shows us he insisted on being hypnotically conditioned to think he really was working for Orcus, while unconsciously he'd be sending Orcus secrets back to the Avengers. Pretty neat. Would you enjoy this twist as much as I did?
I did, yeah. It was, like you're saying, I'm a little bit more familiar with 3D Man in general, and I knew his sort of tenuous relationship with the Avengers, but I didn't take it as like, I'm out to like destroy the Avengers. So that spin was kind of like, I don't know about that. So okay. This was a nice explanation for why he was that sort of mustache twirling bad guy at this point. And the idea of like, you know, sending somebody under deep cover and they're kind of brainwashed to think that they're not undercover is kind of cool.
Yeah, it sounds like he was a good choice to play this part where there is a legitimate, you know, bad history between him and the Avengers, but not so bad that we wouldn't say, oh yeah, and make Avengers, is that Delroy was just a little bit too effective in working for Orcus, right?
Yeah.
Where he's just more efficient than they thought, and they were not expecting to actually have their base attacked and be about to be destroyed by these Sentinels, which would, you know, taking deep cover a bit too far.
Yes.
So T'Challa does eventually get to Delroy, and he says the magic old Wakandan code words to snap him out of his conditioning. Delroy wakes up, calls off the Sentinel attack. Complete victory for the Avengers. The Impossible City is safe, and we're told they managed to destroy a big chunk of Orcus's reserve of Stark Sentinels. Pretty neat. I mean, I guess Delroy could probably order them to self-destruct or fly right into the sun or something. Have we heard anything in the other books about a shortage of Sentinels?
No.
We have that close continuity?
Yeah. I'm still a little unsure when this takes place relative to even just the Iron Man book.
Okay.
Like, did the Iron Man book happen and then this happens? I mean, we haven't really seen... Did we see the real resolution of Iron Man fighting all the baddies in Australia? Maybe we did. I'm getting it all confused.
This must be happening first. That's how I'm... I'm seeing this happening before Iron Man fought the Sentinels there in Australia. One thing that's neat here is that I think we see more Sentinels, like denser number of Sentinels, attack the Impossible City than we see anywhere else in this event. There's like at least two dozen here just flying at the Impossible City, which would make sense if this is when they had all of them and then their numbers got thinned after this incident.
I still just wonder about this and then the big throwdown in Australia, and then finally Sentinel City, right? Maybe the Sentinel City Sentinels were on a different frequency, but it just kind of feels like they should have exhausted them at some point.
What I'm gathering here is that they gave Delroy, like, command of a certain, I don't know, battalion or whatever the right word is for this set of Stark Sentinels, but not – he didn't have the codes for every Sentinel in the entire Orcus organization. How I make it. Now, we're not quite done yet. The last two pages of the issue take place, according to the caption, days later after the fall of Orcus. So, spoiler alert, I guess, Orcus loses. Kind of crazy that the first confirmed look we get at a post-Orcus Marvel Universe is in the Avengers. That surprised me. That made me chuckle a little bit. But this is here to advertise the next crossover event that the Avengers are going to be part of starting in their very next issue. And of course, it is the one called Blood Hunt that you'll be hearing all about, probably until you're sick of it, all 60 issues worth, back on the main Marvel podcast. Were you amused to see After the Fall of Orcus here in our Avengers book?
I was, but also it confuses me a bit because, you know, this all takes place in the Fall of the House of the X timeline, right? But Fall was like 5 years before Rise of the Powers of X. So I don't exactly understand how Orcus falls, and yet in the Rise of the Powers of the X start, like they were basically kicking butt.
What
right?
makes you say that it was 5 years difference there? Because I'm seeing them happening at the same time.
You think Fall, or sorry, Rise happened at the same time as Fall?
Yes, absolutely.
I thought the very first issue was like the time travel shenanigans. Yeah, I thought the first issue was like set some period forward from Fall, but maybe that's my mistake.
No, I think it's very much at the same time. I mean, we saw Professor X call Rasputin away from the rescue of Cyclops, so that was a point of overlap. We saw that last issue. We saw the betrayal of Professor X kind of revealed in Fall, was it issue 4, whatever the most recent one was, and here we see the background of it in today. So yeah, I think they're very much contemporaneous, you know, back and forth. And again, a lot of it is just completely out of the time stream in general, or time travel stuff, so that's a whole different ball.
So here I'm going to defend myself. So you open the first issue of Fall of the House, or sorry, Rise of the Powers of X, it says plus 10 years, the Tower of Nimrod, blah, blah, blah. So at least that part.
Oh yeah, that was a weird. That was the alternate possible future that was being explored, and then they go back to when they go to like the no place. Yeah, that was the weird thing where Kitty had taken the Death Seed, and that was an alternate timeline in general.
Okay, so that's an alternate timeline situation.
Yeah, the main continuity of Rise with, you know, Professor X doing his thing with. You know, showing up in the real world and talking to Orcus, that's happening at the same time as Fall, for sure.
Got it. Okay.
Okay, so just to wrap up Avengers, yeah, I like this book a lot. The twist works for me. It fooled me just enough to make me say, okay, that was a clever twist. Completely bought into 3D Man being a part of Orcus, so the reveal worked very well. I love seeing existing continuity being used in a creative way to tell this story. And it was continuity not just being used for a, hey, look at me, I know how to use a wiki. It was actually making the character serve a story. And that was the kind of thing I want to see more of. And really, it makes me a little bit more optimistic for the adjectiveless X-Men book that McKay will be writing coming out in a couple months. Mortarino's art is very cool. I loved seeing the Avengers having this enormous battle with Stark Sentinels in space with just tons and tons of Sentinels. So yeah, not at all a necessary tie-in. Not super ambitious, but a fun story, and one that's more clever than initially gave it credit for. So I'm going to give Avengers 13, and I guess I'm kind of giving it a little bonus, because in retrospect, I gave the first issue too low of a score. So I'm going to call this one a makeup 8.3 out of 10.
Wow. Yep, I'll go 7.5. As you know, it didn't seem like it was necessary to the main plot, but there was some fun stuff. And I don't know if it necessarily added anything, but it was nice to see the Avengers trying to help out the X-Men get involved in this.
If you think of like, I don't know, diving scoring in the Olympics, where they have like your actual score out of 10, and then like there's a level of difficulty, this is the lower difficulty book compared with what we're going forward to look at. So I'm going to give the other books a little lower score, but you know, they're trying to do something much bigger and much harder. This is just a nice little well-made, more simple kind of.
The one question I'm going to have is, where were the Avengers when Sentinel City was like solar nuking the Earth, right? Were they up on their Impossible City flipping hamburgers?
That is an excellent question, but I mean, that is the nature of, you know, big two comic books, event storytelling. You can't have the Avengers show up to solve everything, because that would be boring. But yep, that is a worthwhile question to ask. We are going to move on from our Avengers friends and get back to the heart of the event here in Rise of the Powers of X, number 4 of 5, Sentinel X, written by Kieran Gillen, art by R.B. Silva, colors by David Curiel, letters by Clayton Cowles, designed by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. So yes, this issue and X-Men Forever are essentially two parts of the same story. So frequently, I think in this discussion, we're going to say things like, oh, this will make more sense when we get to the next issue. So yeah, that's going to happen. It's just no way around. We also learned this week that R.B. Silva is not going to be the artist on the 5th and final issue of this book, which is a real bummer. I mean, his look, he has a very distinctive look, doesn't look like any other artist, and it's been a big part of the identity of this title. I don't know who's going to be filling in. I'm sure it's going to look good, but I hate it when a book like this doesn't have a coherent art look to it. And I know that, again, that's the nature of modern big two comic book storytelling, but doesn't mean I have to like it. So internally to the book, we have a few things going on. We have a bunch of scenes following Xavier and his machinations. We have some goings on in the Atlantic Krakoa in the White Hot Room. And we have one short but important scene featuring Enigma. Now let's start with Xavier. We pick up about 2 seconds after the end of issue 3. Our hero, Dr. Professor Charles Xavier, has just heroically shot a woman in the back, unprovoked. That'd be Rachel. Rasputin IV, who looked on in horror as this happened, is now trying to murder Xavier to death. Quite reasonable reaction, given what Xavier has just done and the kind of day Rasputin has had. Xavier makes a deal with Mother Righteous, which is never a good idea. Xavier will free Righteous from her egg-like prison, and in exchange, Mother Righteous will use her "you thanked me" power to prevent Rasputin from murdering Xavier. Win-win from a certain point of view. So Mother Righteous is frozen like a statue. Well, not Mother Righteous. Mother Righteous freezes Rasputin like a statue with a giant sword blade just inches from Xavier's chest. Very dramatic. Xavier needs Rasputin dead too, but she is much tougher than Rachel was. Xavier needs to shoot her in the back of the head over and over some bloody unspecified number of times before that deed is fully done. Now, Ruben, you know, I don't think we're supposed to be all that sympathetic to Xavier here. Not a real nice man. So what do you think of our hero's actions in this opening scene?
Our hero? I don't know. I mean, he... I have a sense that he's just like, he's crossed the line and he's just going to do whatever it takes to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish at this point.
He is definitely committed to his plan. Just that one panel of him behind Rasputin just blasting away. It's just, oh my gosh.
I mean, he shut off her pain receptors. That's kind of nice.
That is his idea of being nice. Yes, that's Charles Xavier in a nutshell. I'm going to be so nice to you by shutting off your pain receptors while I slowly and brutally kill you to make my plan work. So Rachel's dead. Rasputin IV is dead. And Mother Righteous says that she's figured out how to make that homunculus version of herself in the White Hot Room melt away. And we're going to see more of that in X-Men Forever.
I also want to say one thing. So people probably know I get into these characters that'll do anything for their vision, right? Like, this is an Abigail Brand type maneuver.
For sure.
For sure. So obviously I'm like, oh yeah, this Xavier like is amusing me. But I do want to point out to everybody, like, everyone has to remember, yeah, he's doing like ridiculous stuff, but what is he fighting, right? Like, he's fighting some AI that can see everything and be everywhere at every time, right? And so at this point, I'm not even sure they 100% have confidence that like the no place is, you know, not viewable. So I always think like maybe some of the stuff
the
is
no
just...
The no place is on fire and burning to nothingness. So it's not going to last much longer.
Yeah. So sometimes I'm like, they've said the only thing that the Enigma can't see is in your brain, right? So some of this might just be theater for, you know, trying to position yourself a certain way in the view of this AI.
I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind here is that Xavier, I don't think even sees Orcus as his enemy anymore.
Yeah.
It's all about Enigma. He'll do anything to fight Enigma. And again, we don't really know what why Enigma even cares about the mutants anymore, right? Maybe if Xavier ignores Enigma goes off into space and does his Dominion things and they can ignore each other. But no, Professor Xavier is sure that, oh, this is a Sinister who became a Dominion. Only thing that matters is defeating that Dominion.
Yep.
And even if that takes, you know, murdering friends and making peace with Orcus, once he gets an idea in his mind, he is not what you'd consider like a reasonable human being. He's very single-minded, which can be really, you know, effective, but it just means that he doesn't act like a normal, reasonable person would, because he doesn't, once he's made that decision, all these little human hanging on portions, he's just decided they don't matter, and he acts like they don't matter.
I'd say the other thing too, and I hate to justify this, is, but I can understand this characterization of him. I kind of like it. I've seen a lot of people just being like, oh, this isn't Xavier, I don't buy it, but he is kind of smarter than everybody else, right? So I don't expect him to like really take everybody's point of view into consideration. He's a genius, right? Like, maybe if you have Reed Richards talking to him, he like will say, oh, it's one of my peers, right? I'll consider his point of view. But
yeah, he is a genius and he knows it.
Yeah.
Right? He's not modest in any sense. he's sure that he's the only person who can save the world over and over again, and he's convinced that whatever he has to do is justified. And that is a consistent Professor X thing for I don't know how many decades now, but yeah, he's not a good character, but he's a good character.
You know yeah. What I mean? Yeah, exactly. And I don't know. I mean, he's he's the only one that's going to beat this threat in my mind. So yeah, I get that he's doing things that are sort of shocking and outrageous, but
he has his reasons.
Yep. He has his reasons. Yeah.
So it is time for the next step in Xavier's plan, which is making that deal with Orcus. He brings the No Place back into standard Marvel reality just off the coast of Pacific Krakoa. No Place looking quite the worst for wear after all those Skullface Stark Sentinel battles. Yeah, I'm pretty sure the No Place is done with. I think it's gone. It's burned to bits. One thing I don't quite understand is why, once we're back in reality, Mother Righteous is passed out unconscious. She seemed fine a minute ago. Did Xavier use her as like a power source to get back into reality? Is that what happened? Is that how the No Place works?
Yeah, unknown. Something happens. I mean, she says, "What are you doing?" Right? And she talks about she's a useful girl. And then he says, "You already are." And then he says, "What are you doing?" And
right. That's what makes me think that
yeah.
She's like a battery for this No Place. And this big move is just, you know, draining her temporarily. Somehow she needs to be unconscious or at least not actively fighting when they get here to Krakoa. Because what Xavier's here for is to psychically reach out to Orcus and say, hey, guys, I've got Mother Righteous here. I've got, you know, the sort of kind of wife of sort of kind of Dr. Stasis. I'm sure you want her. Let's talk.
I mean, he could put her to sleep, right? He's got that ability. So I don't know. There's a variety of things he could have done. Yeah,
it could have been that. I would expect if he had done that, we would have seen some sort of indication that he was actively doing that. And, you know, Mother Righteous is a strong character, too, so she probably has defenses. I'm just curious what's going on. Not quite clear. As we cut to the next scene, we don't get to see exactly how he makes contact with Orcus. You know, whether he gets picked up by Sentinels. I don't know why the Sentinels aren't just, you know, trained to kill him on sight. But however it works out, we see him being, you know, bound hand and foot and being questioned by Omega Sentinel. Omega Sentinel says that Dr. Stasis is dead, which places this scene clearly after Fall of the House of X number 3, because that's where Dr. Stasis got brutally murdered by Jerry Duggan's crew. And we get to see the deal made here that was revealed to the world in Fall of the House of X number 4. So we're definitely in that time frame. Xavier sums this deal up as, quote, "Let the mutants live and to hell with humanity," which, again, he's made his decision that he's going to protect what he considers to be his people. Which is, you know, as we've seen, his idea of what the mutant should be, living with humanity, living separate from humanity. Beginning with House of X number 1, he had said, not exactly to hell with humanity, but pretty close, right? He was saying, we're going to live on our own separately, and we're going to be nice to you, but we're out for our own good. And this is really the ultimate expression of that. So when he's asked by Orcus how he'd be useful, Xavier refers to himself as the Ultimate Sentinel, which explains the issue title, which is Sentinel X, and Nimrod himself calls Xavier Sentinel X, so I think that title might stick to Xavier for a while, and probably explains why he's not super prominent in the upcoming From the Ashes era.
At this point, I don't think you need to have, like, he's still possessed by Sinister for people to be like, I don't trust that guy.
No, he's done some bad stuff. He's probably killed those people in that spaceship last issue. Yes. He's killing more humans in this issue. And again, maybe we'll find out that he was really just teleporting them somewhere somehow, but
it kind of
seems like they're dead.
Yeah.
So Xavier's first service to Orcus is to psychically identify all the human scientists who aren't completely 100% on board with the whole Orcus thing. And Nimrod then kills all the ones who didn't get high enough score. Nimrod said he's shooting out knife sentinels, which that might just be Nimrod being silly schmilly Nimrod. I don't know if knife sentinels are really a thing. Did you just buy that as his funny name for laser beams?
Yeah.
Probably. Super bloody shot there where, you know, you can imagine all these scientists lined up, and we don't know exactly how Xavier is indicating to Nimrod which ones to kill and which ones not to, but it's hard to see this as being any kind of a trick. We see scientists' head just being vaporized. So, yeah, Xavier's clearly guilty here. Next, Xavier messes with the brains of all human world leaders, adding a, quote, cognitive drain to each of them that's just enough to keep them from effectively working together against Orcus. Pretty sneaky. And finally, for now, Orcus needs another doomsday weapon in case the X-Men take out Sentinel City. So I think this is happening right at the same time that the X-Men are attacking Sentinel City over in Fall of the House of X. So I think we really are super, super overlapping with that story. So Xavier gives them the, quote, nuclear codes. I don't know if that's just the U.S. codes or every nuclear code in the whole world. Unclear, but enough to be certainly very dangerous. So Xavier had been talking with Omega Sentinel, but in the last panel of this sequence, we see Moira there, and she kind of comes out of nowhere. Again, this is a little confusing where this is happening, who he's talking to. Is she really there, or are we just the readers being reminded of Moira? But in that panel, Charles says, we don't see him, just his word bubble. He says, for once, us mutants must be on the winning side, which, of course, calls back to a whole bunch of stuff. Moira, earlier on, seeing that, quote, mutants always lose. Omega Sentinel, from her original timeline, saying that there, mutants always win. And Destiny saying to Mr. Sinister, we must be on the same side. And let's not forget, in Rise number 3, Xavier seemed to maybe sort of kind of have implanted a psychic command in the mind of young Moira. And if he did, does that command even still exist inside the computer mind of Robo-Moira? Is Xavier angling for a chance to play that card at some point? I don't know. So we still think something happened with young Moira, right? That seemed pretty clearly indicated.
Yeah, I don't know if it was like a card to be played. I mean, I would have preferred to have been more explicit, but I think it might be at the end, like, up to her free will to do something to stop Enigma.
Something definitely has to happen with Moira. She is going to be a very key player in this, and whether it's on her own initiative or something from Professor X coming to the surface, we'll have to wait and see. So what do we think Xavier's big picture plan is now? I think it really is just he's switched his major enemy over to Enigma, and he's willing to do anything at all, willing to get them, even hooking up with Orcus.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm not sure. Maybe his view is the AIs will defeat humanity, then humanity and mutants will approach Enigma. And maybe they're not going to try to defeat Enigma. Maybe they'll just become their own dominion as well.
Maybe. It's really unclear to me. And I think maybe I'll hold off on speculating until we get to X-Men Forever, because we get a little bit of more information over there. So let's go over to the White Hot Room now. The Five immediately resurrect Rachel, and it wasn't clear to me right away when I read this issue first how they knew to do this, how they knew that Rachel was even dead, and that gets all cleared up in X-Men Forever. Rachel's first words are, Xavier, he killed me. He's going to do something terrible. And Destiny says, we know. And again, at least at this point, very unclear what Destiny actually knows. Which remains still kind of unclear after the next issue, but we'll argue about that later. On the next page, Hope and Exodus talk to Rachel, and Hope is apologetic. None of us like this. I'm sorry we didn't tell you. And again, exactly what they could have told her, pretty confusing and unclear. Did Hope know that Xavier was going to kill Rachel? I mean, that was Xavier's final plan, only if neither of his first two plans worked, right? We saw the first two plans fail, and now this is last-ditch effort. Hope does say, you kickstart the Phoenix, it kicks Enigma's ass, you get back to Earth and kick whatever Orcus ass you can find. And on the next page, Rachel says, what the hell is Xavier even going to be doing for Orcus? So again, the Xavier works with Orcus plan is known to the White Hot Room mutants, which makes more sense after X-Men Forever. Very notable that when Rachel is brought back, her hair quickly becomes all flamey, right? Literally, her hair is on fire in every panel, very Phoenix-y. Very much pointing towards that being her role now. And you know, it's drawn by R.B. Silva, so it looks super, super cool. As an aside, it does seem that a fully current, up-to-date version of Rachel has been brought back. She has memories right up to her death. Should I worry about how that works, right? I mean, there is a cerebral cradle on Atlantic Rakoa, but
yeah.
How could that current mental backup be there when Rachel died outside of time and space? And I hope your explanation doesn't have the phrase waiting room in it, because that would make me sad.
My explanation is going to have the word Phoenix in it, which is not as satisfying. It's Phoenix stuff, man.
I guess. You say something like Xavier himself transfers her consciousness. I don't know. It's but Xavier needs her to be fully up to date, and so she is. She is a Phoenix Seed type person, so she dies and goes to the White Hot Room. Maybe, yeah. Well, she doesn't die and go but to the White Hot Room. She is resurrected there, and not in a Phoenix kind of way, but in a Mutant the Five kind of a way.
Yeah, maybe just like you said, he does a quick mind scan, transfers it to the cradle somehow.
It has to be very quick because it can't even be from 5 seconds before he shot her, because then she wouldn't know that he shot her. That's a thing I'd like to ask Kieran Gillen over a couple of years, but that's not going to happen. She's there. She knows everything. We're going to have to go with it. Next scene, a procession of Rachel and the dead X-Men. Hey, there they are. That crew is still around. Still kind of important, it seems. They're taking Jean to what appears to be her funeral pyre, which is a bit strange as Jean is not quite dead. It's weird because she's the only one who got to the White Hot Room by dying, because she is the Phoenix. So she is kind of more dead than anybody else there, but she also keeps repeating now and forever over and over again. So makes the idea of putting her on a funeral pyre extra creepy. Much, much more of this in X-Men Forever. But now we need to get Rachel and a bunch of other White Hot Room mutants back to Earth. Hope leads this meeting. She says that everyone with X training or any damn combat training has been resurrected and is ready to get back into the fray. More on how they knew to do this. X-Men Forever. And indeed, we see there in the crowd, among them, there is, well, it's Warren Worthington III, a.k.a. Angel. Now, in Dark X-Men, we saw Angel dead, and then undead, and then really dead, so cool to see Warren here. Rasputin IV is here, too. That's kind of nifty. Other characters in the crowd include Pixie, Hellion, Chamber, and one of the Stepford Cuckoos. So, I think one use of the scene is we can now say that anybody who died in anything, really, since the gala, since anything, if a writer later on wants to use that character, it's super easy for them to say, oh, this is where that character was resurrected. Even if we don't specifically see it, very handy scene. But now let's go back to Rasputin. She asks an important question. With Mother Righteous's puppet gone, how is there any communication between the White Hot Room and Earth? And she gets the answer from a surprising source. It is Mr. Sinister. I was shocked to see him on panel. I thought he was gone. I thought he was done.
Yes.
But everybody Xavier kills is coming back here, so it makes sense. Rasputin, very much not happy about this. Damn near kills him again, which would just make more work for the Five, because they'd have to bring him back. But yeah, that was a nice reaction scene. And R.B. Silva draws Rasputin's face a little bit differently than most other artists, so it took me just a second to be totally sure that's who it was. But once she tries to murder Mr. Sinister, oh yeah, that's Rasputin. That's who that is.
Yeah, I was happy to see him back, because this is my favorite take on Sinister.
Kieran Gillen's Sinister is a joy every time.
Yes, to think that he's going to keep going brings me joy.
Just the banter between them, where the way he tries to defend himself or, you know, calm down Rasputin by saying, hey, maybe you can kill me again later. Or, you know, maybe long shot, maybe I'll redeem myself. And Rasputin says, yeah, you won't. And the Sinister says, yeah, see, you're learning. Very good. Classic dialogue there. A nice little bit of comic relief in the middle of a very grim plot.
Yeah.
So Sinister's here. He says that as far as communication, he still has Doug Ramsey's mutant gift. He can talk to Krakoa here in the White Hot Room, and Krakoa has some mystical hand-wavy connection to the rest of itself over there in reality. And I don't love this explanation, but this explanation comes back over and over and over again, so I think I just have to kind of accept it. And I'm still working on that, but yeah, Krakoa here is connected to Krakoa there, and they can make stuff happen between them. Okay, I guess we're just going to go with that. Let's see. Sinister says the connection between the two parts of Krakoa can also be used to transport people, or mutants, from here to there. And we see, we're cutting some things that we're going to see in X-Men Forever, we see three characters emerging from flowers on real-world Krakoa, and it's definitely Rachel, it's definitely Jubilee, and the third person in the background with the red hair. When I read this issue, I said, oh, that's Hope. It really very much looks like Hope. But it can't be Hope because of reasons that'll come up in the next book. So You had a theory, Ruben. You thought it might be Firestar?
I did, but you told me the kind of common theory is that it's just miscolored Dazzler. And I looked back at the outfit Dazzler's wearing in some of the other scenes with like the yellow leg band.
Yeah.
And I buy that.
I think that makes the most sense, is that it's supposed to be Dazzler, but the colorist just didn't get the memo. There's another coloring issue a couple pages earlier where we see Chamber from behind. You can tell it's Chamber because he has the glowing thing coming out, you know, from his chest and chin area. But from behind, he's colored with blonde hair like he's Cypher. And then when we see him from the front, he has the correct brown colored hair. So I think there were just some communication issues with the colorist, and maybe that'll get cleaned up in the trade. But I think we're just going to go with this being Dazzler because it can't be Hope. Hope is definitely staying behind in the White Hot Room.
I wish it would get fixed, but I have a feeling it won't. It just reminds me of the old man Cable that was in X of Swords for some random reason.
Yeah, somebody missed a memo. That didn't get fixed in the trade?
I haven't checked, but
oh well.
At least with Cable, you can pretend like maybe it is the time-traveling version for some reason.
He can go back and forth as many times as you need because he's Cable. Okay, back to this issue. One last bit about Enigma. Mother Reich has been turned over to Orcus by Xavier. She trusted Xavier's deal here, and that's always a bad idea. You know, both of them trusting each other was never going to work out great for either one of them, but it seems that Xavier has come out on top for now. She's inside this Orcus cell with these magical scribbles around that's probably trying to, you know, keep her contained. But it doesn't keep out of Dominion. She's contacted by Enigma. And in such a situation, what else could Mother Righteous say but, please don't kill me, and I'll tell you everything. This was a miscalculation by Xavier. I think, again, unless it turns out to be some, oh, I planned this all along, but Mother Righteous knows his plan, at least as far as we know his plan, and once she's back in regular reality, she is vulnerable to Enigma, just like anybody. So now Enigma knows the one secret that we think he's not supposed to know, that Xavier is planning on calling in the Phoenix, a power that has been in the past to be shown to be able to defeat even Dominions, including an Omega Sentinel's original timeline. And now I guess there's a Dominion chat room or email server. At least that's how it's shown in the design, which is fine. We can't really understand Dominion, so it has to be dumbed down for our silly three-dimensional human brains. Enigma sends a message to all the other Dominions, informing them of this threat, and the other Dominions write back, if the Phoenix returns, we will all come. So I guess that multiplies the stakes even larger. Not that I know the difference between fighting one infinite Dominion and fighting multiple infinite Dominions, because, you know, in my math classes, five times infinity is still infinity, but it is a pretty cool ending, and it is Gillen saying, hey, this is getting even bigger than you thought it was going
to
get.
Yeah, I'm curious to see, just weird curiosity, like how many are going to show up? How many is the all, right?
And how is that going to be shown on panel? Usually when we see Dominions, it's like in that Resurrection of Magneto thing where it's kind of metaphorical and mathematical and geometrical. And how it's going to be multiple Dominions being part of this, whatever happens, is I'm curious how that's going to be shown.
Yeah, if nothing else, it should be like Phalanx and Enigma, but I'm curious what else will be considered a Dominion.
Yeah, a lot to look forward to. So some really big stuff in this issue. We had Dominions, we had Sinister back, all those resurrected mutants. The art all looks great, you know, minor coloring issues aside. Just the intensity, it's almost like, is the term jewel tones appropriate here? I think that's what I'm seeing in the colors. I've seen that in my wife talks about some of the blouses she wears being jewel-toned, which is the only reason I even know that phrase.
I was like, I'm not sure what you're talking
about. Intense and glowing, and it just has a look unlike any other book, and I'm really enjoying that. So maybe even if R.B. Silva is out, if they keep the same colorist who is, as I'm scrolling back up, boy, a lot of notes here, David Curiel, if he can maintain that same look in the colors, I think that'll help to maintain the look of the book itself. Let's see. I think that splash page of the three of them returning back to Krakoa, that looks amazing, even now that I know that it's supposed to be Dazzler. I found the story, especially before I read X-Men Forever, very confusing. Slightly less confusing after that, and I'm not sure how much of the confusion is on purpose, certainly a lot of it, but it's still not completely satisfying to me. And since this is only kind of half a story, I kind of have to give this issue a relatively low score of like a 7.8 out of 10, which is very low for me for a Kieran Gillen book. And it may turn out to be, in retrospect, brilliant that everything makes sense, and I want to go back and apologize to him. But for right now, it was just a little bit too confusing, even aside from coloring issues. How about you? Am I being too hard on this?
It's 7.8 too hard. I feel like we're somebody on Comic Book Roundup, right? I don't know, man. I always enjoy the Kieran Gillen stuff, and I have enough faith in him as a writer that when it does feel fast and stuff doesn't totally make sense, I expect it to make more sense when I'm done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like after having read X-Men Forever, a lot of my confusion was kind of resolved. So I'm just going to give it a straight 8. This is not like mind-blowing or anything, but there were enough moments where I was amused by what was going on.
That's very fair. Yeah, I wasn't sure that I should really take X-Men Forever into account because this book should stand on its own. Right?
Yeah,
X-Men Forever is a cool book, and I'm glad it's there, but the idea that you have to read that to understand what's going on here in the main event book, you know, one of the two co-main event books, that's asking a bit much, I think. So I think it would be better if the book made sense on its own rather than, oh, you got to go read this other thing to see what's really happening.
I mean, that's certainly fair criticism. After this, I went and looked to see like how the trades are going to be collected, and they're not including X-Men Forever in the Fall Rise like collection. And I was like, that seems like a miss because it feels like they gave him X-Men Forever as like a way to, you know, hit all these points that he felt like he needed to fit in to the story. I don't know how you'd understand this like without reading that as well.
Yeah, that's a weird call. You could almost just alternate scenes or pages, right? Show the scene from one book and then show a scene from the other book. And
yeah,
just like they did with what they did with House and Powers, right? What was that they did with the
The chronological edition. The
chronological edition. Yeah, you could definitely do that with these two books. But let's move on to that other issue. Whoops. This is X-Men Forever, number 2 of 4, Quiet Council, written once again by Kieran Gillen. This art is by Luca Maresca, colors by Federico Blee, letters by Clayton Cowles, designed by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen and Kat Gregorowitz. I think compared with Rise number 4, X-Men Forever number 2 was a relatively straightforward linear narrative. We don't have a single point of view character, and there's no internal monologue narration boxes, but we follow essentially just the story of the mutants inside the White Hot Room during the same time period. We see some of the scenes again from a new perspective, and there's some other scenes that are entirely new. Xavier doesn't really appear in this book. He kind of does, but in a strange way we'll get to. There's a lot of editorial footnotes in this issue, which every time I see an editorial footnote, it brings me out of the world a little bit, and it gives the story a lighter tone. It does one of those things Jim hates where it refers to, in this case, Dead X-Men as a classic, even though it came out like 3 weeks ago and wasn't all that classic. But it is correct that X-Men Forever, if we said that, reading Rise of the Powers of X without X-Men Forever would be confusing, can you imagine someone going the other way, reading only X-Men Forever? It would make no sense.
Yeah.
So if this is going to be published as its own trade paperback, that would be maybe a bad idea.
Yeah. I'll tell somebody I really like X-Men and be like, hey, this is the jumping on point.
you like the new X-Men 97 on Disney Plus? Here you go. Read this. X-Men Forever. Ugh. Okay, so let's get into the book itself. We open on Atlantic Krakoa at a time when that Mother Righteous Homunculus is still around. So we're kind of a little bit back in time. Or maybe at the same time as we saw them in the No Place. If there is an even time in the No Place, don't hurt your brain thinking about that. Mother Righteous here isn't going to be around for long anyway. She gives Destiny and Company a, quote, update from Earth, tells them Sinister's dead, Xavier killed Rachel, that the Earth Mother Righteous is out of her cage, and this Mother Righteous is about to melt away. See ya, suckers. At this point, Xavier takes control of the disgustingly melting homunculus, really gross, and adds in a few more pertinent details and instructions. He wants the Five to resurrect Rachel, and also attaches a file to his mental email here that goes to, I think, just to Destiny, that lists, quote, all the X-Men who have died in Orcus purges and wants all of them brought back too. So this is how they knew who to resurrect. Much more sense now. Now, before Xavier goes, Destiny reminds him of their, quote, deal. And Xavier's all, you know, I can't do that right now. I'm unable to. Plus, you can't be distracted. We have other fish to fry. He says, I, Xavier, need you, Destiny, with, quote, a clear mind. Destiny confirms later on this issue that this deal has to do with Nightcrawler's secret origin, that whole X-Men Blue thing, but she won't go into details. What do you think is going on here? What could their deal be?
I mean, if it involves Xavier, maybe it's a mind wipe thing to get some, maybe Destiny gets some sympathy from Mystique.
I would think so, but remember, so he wiped her mind of everything. He wiped Mystique's minds of some things because Mystique wanted to remember that Nightcrawler was her child, even though mother, father, that was confused. But Xavier also wiped all memory of having wiped the memory from his own brain. So unless that got undone at some time, I don't know how he'd even know there was a deal because both people involved had their minds wiped. Clearly it's important and we'll be finding out something about it in the next couple issues. Next scene, we jump ahead to right after all those resurrections are accomplished. I guess not quite all, because there's a bit of disagreement about bringing back Sinister. Destiny is the loudest voice arguing in favor of bringing him back. Tells Exodus, hey, if we bring him back, then maybe you get to be the one to kill him in the future. Very much parallel with Sinister saying to Rasputin, hey, maybe later you get to kill me. So there's definitely going to be a competition who gets to kill Sinister this time. And of course, Destiny reminds him once again of that whole we must be on the same side bit that goes all the way back to Gillen's very first book in this run, Immortal Number One. At this point, Destiny fills in the rest of the, quote, quiet council in exile and what's been happening on Earth. Orcus being taken over by the AIs, the existence of Enigma, all that nonsense. Presumably, this was all in that psychic email from Xavier. She says that Xavier is joining the AIs for two purposes. Very clearly, two purposes. She says the first is to keep mutants alive, although this will mean that he will have to, you know, participate in killing humans for Orcus. And this just blows up the meeting. Rachel interrupts. There's a big fight over whether this is okay or not, as if they have any influence over what Xavier is doing back in the world. But they argue anyway. But more importantly to me, Destiny never gets to the second reason Xavier joined Orcus. I kept going back and forth trying to say, oh, does she say it off to the side? No. She sets up, there's two reasons, never gets to the second reason, which is, oh, so irritating, but in a very clever way. I can tell Gillen was doing this on purpose. He's letting us know there is another level of secrets in Xavier's plan. It goes so many levels deep, and there is something there, but we don't get to know it yet.
Yeah.
Oh, what a jerk you are, Kieran Gillen.
Well, it's intriguing. Dangles a carrot, right? I'm assuming we'll find out in the final issue.
There's not that many issues left. We have, after this, there's two more issues of X-Men Forever, one more issue of Rise of the Powers of X, and then there's that wedding special, but really three more issues for all these secrets to be revealed. So better get busy. Moving on, we're going to spend a moment with Rachel. She's with Jean, who is still semi-unconscious, still incessantly saying, now and forever. Prodigy wanders in. He's the smart guy from Dead X-Men. And here, Kieran Gillen makes Dead X-Men retroactively just a little bit more important, which is kind of fun. Rachel pushes Prodigy into a tangle of Krakoan tendrils, points out that he was connected to the Macron crystal, has a bunch of mystical stuff in him connected to the Phoenix. This calls back to, you know, the crystal being inside the crystal, which is inside the white hot room, which is inside the Phoenix, which is inside the crystal. All that mystical hand wavy stuff that makes my brain hurt. Krakoan letters appear behind Prodigy. Now, did you go and translate these Krakoan letters the way I did? Because I have no life.
No, I did not. Yeah, tell me what's it say.
The first
one. I don't
think
I've translated any of these letters in any of the issues since this whole series began.
The first four letters say fire. Mm-hmm. The second four letters say life. Very Phoenix-y.
I thought you were going to say Phoenix-y. Starter, and then I was going to say awesome.
No, he's not
Prodigy,
quite
right? That would have been so good.
just we're deep into Phoenix territory here. Rachel says, I'm taking the essences of all those realities and printing them into Krakoa itself. like a blueprint, an idea, an inspiration, and then throwing it all into a pyre. Yeah, very mystical, very hand-wavy, very Phoenix-y, and some crazy Phoenix stuff is going to go on with Jean Grey, and this is just using dead X-Men bits to kind of ramp it up another level. I think kind of like he did with, oh, now we've got more Dominions coming in, now we've got even more Phoenix, Macron, Crystal mysticism going in. It's another, and she, Rachel also says that if this plan doesn't work, she has another one ready. So clearly being around Professor X has rubbed off on her. She has plans within plans within plans. Next, we get a quiet scene between Exodus and Kafka, that little kid mutant with bug wings who's been kind of hanging around the edges of all this white hot room things since all the mutants got sent here after the gala. It's made clear to us that while some of these mutants, the X-Men, the one who can fight, will be going home from the white hot room back to reality, a lot of them, probably most of them, won't be going. A ton of mutants are just going to be left behind. And Exodus says that when Phoenix is resurrected, knock on wood, that will change the nature of the white hot room, and the ones who leave won't be able to return and bring back the ones who were left behind. So for all these other kind of regular background type mutants, they're going to have to live here in the Phoenix afterlife, farming tubers and stuff indefinitely, which is kind of interesting to think about.
Yeah.
Exodus says, you know, this wasn't his plan. He expected to be kind of the Messiah, or, you know, serving the Messiah. He expected to sacrifice himself to bring everybody else home, but that's not how it's going to work. He does say to Kafka, everything I did for Krakoa. Don't know if I buy that. He does it for Hope, and Hope is working for Krakoa, so I guess transitive property, but no, let's stay sentimental. He did it for Krakoa. He says, you, the ones left behind, are Krakoa. You are the important ones, which is a touching moment. And after I, you know, feel touched for a moment, I get a little more cynical and say, hey, this is a really convenient way for the mutant population of Earth post-Krakoa to be as low as the new writers and editors want it to be. Right? We had all these millions of mutants on Krakoa. Most of them got shipped to the White Hot Room. Most of them are staying there. So we don't need to worry about what to do with all these millions of mutants. Pretty convenient. What did you think of this scene as I have a sip of my tea?
I felt like it was touching. I'm kind of curious like who they plan to omit from it. But maybe it's just an answer of like, hey, there were millions and now there's not millions.
I think that's the big plan, and just like for that resurrection scene, future writers can say, oh, this character I want to use, oh, he was resurrected there. If you don't want a character around anymore, oh, that character is left behind in the White Hot Room, and there's always a, you know, get-out-of-jail card. If they're in the White Hot Room, somebody else can make up an excuse to go there and bring them back if you really want them back. So they can revisit this whole crew if some, you know, 20 years from now, some editorial team that's, you know, not headed by Tom Brevoort wants to bring these characters back, they're available. They're not actually dead.
Yeah. And we see Beak at some point, right? So I was like, oh, maybe they're getting rid of them.
Is that Beak carrying that basket of tubers?
Yeah. Unless there's another Beak.
The mutants we see, they all have like physical things. Like there's a little guy with pointy ears, like an orc maybe. There's a Cthulhu looking guy with tentacles on his face, or somebody with goat horns. I think the idea is just all the ones, and we've seen in the White Hot Room since Immortal X-Men after the gala, there's just tons of regular old mutants who don't have super useful powers. Yeah. They're just all here.
That's I guess some of the most important things, we look at the big scene of like everybody standing around and you see Forget-Me-Not, right? I think we were laughing about that.
That's what
we
get to next.
He came back, he's a little heavy. But you also have the five, right? So I guess this is how they get rid of the mutant resurrection cycle. They get resurrected, but they're in the White Hot Room and they can't come back.
Well, let's talk about this. So it's time to send the mutants who are going to go back to reality. It's time to send it back. And we have a very cool big panel here of a whole group scene of mutants. I looked through it for a while to identify mutants, and I found some other lists of who people see here. So let's talk about that. I do think that pretty much everybody here, except for Hope, goes back to reality. So I do think the five are going back. But again, it's not super clear. I think they all go back. So here we have in this group scene, we have the five, Proteus, Hope, Egg, Tempest, and Elixir. And then, yeah, we see Forget-Me-Not, who died in Legion of X. which I was very happy to see him here. You're right. He doesn't look like he looked in Legion of X. Legion of X, he looked, you know, more slim, more fit. He was, you know, working on that team. Here he goes back to an older model where he's, let's just say he's kind of pot-bellied. He's not looking like he's ready to take on Orca single-handedly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what is your theory as how he made it here to the White Hot Room?
I thought it was a mistake, but then I was doing some research on this, and apparently there's some canonical story about how Xavier has a memory, like, trigger that goes off periodically to remind him about this character. And since
Like I have my phone remind me to take my pills every morning.
Yeah, exactly.
Like that.
Since he's the guy that's, like, advising everybody, right, on who to bring back, it sort of makes sense that, like, okay, yeah, then he would have known for good, when that wasn't around, and would give the,
so he was on the list of resurrectees. Makes sense. I mean, exactly how his power works, it's a very Grant Morrison-y thing. You know, would his power cancel out Xavier's mental thing? But it's good that he's back. I'm very happy to see him back. I don't think it can make perfect sense because his power is just that weird, but it's good to see him back. We also see a little group of villains, or, you know, sometime villains, Exodus, Mr. Sinister, Destiny, and Rasputin. Further right and facing us, we see Chamber, Archangel, and Pixie. We've seen them before in Rise. Next group, a guy who looks like Grey Crow, Fabian Cortez. That's kind of neat. Haven't seen him in a long time. We get Cerebella, who was formerly No Girl, so, you know, the floating brain in a jar. We get Transonic. We get four of the Stepford Cuckoos, the fifth being Phoebe is still with X-Force, so I'm glad they didn't put five here. That would have been a mistake. We also get Karma, Wolfsbane, Mentallo, and Hellion. Next group are a little harder to identify, although the woman in blue with the gauntlets, that's Surge, who she's going to be part of the new X-Force book written by Jeffrey Thorne, so her past is coming from the White Hot Room. That's kind of cool to know. And then in the bottom right-hand corner, we see the dead X-Men cast, Dazzler, Jubilee, Prodigy, Frenzy, and Cannonball. So Dazzler is here. So that's another way that we think that the miscoloration in Rise, that's probably Dazzler. And then there's a bunch of too small to identify characters, others just out of frame, which again gives writers in the future license to make it that so any character they want could have been in this scene. Pretty cool. And this really is showing how the writers here are going to be resetting things so that the next set of writers and editors can do what they want to do. Now, Sinister says some more mystical, hand-wavy, metaphysical stuff about the islands being connected, and this is similar to how he piloted the No Place and his Cypher Doug Ramsey powers. And now, oh, I can only do this once. It's going to use up most of the power remaining here, this little bit of Krakoa, so that's why we can't do it with everybody. But he makes some vines and flowers appear. They swallow up all of the mutants that are around. And presumably, everybody here reappears over on Pacific Krakoa, even though in Hope we only saw the three of them.
I'd say there's two very important omissions from here. We don't see Abigail Brand. So my belief that she's not dead was buoyed up a little bit. And then I didn't see Gorgon, but I guess he... Mm. I don't remember where his status is. I think he was like in the Legion-verse area.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure where his story is taken, but that's an interesting notification. Yeah, Abigail Brand, yeah, she's very much still alive in wherever the hell she got stashed by the Fisher King. And Tom Brevoort has said that he wants to do more solo-focused books. So, hey, maybe we'll get an Abigail Brand solo mini.
Oh,
that'd be really something. Just call it Thanria Guaxis, number one. That'll be a big seller. That'll be flying off the shelves.
Yes.
Okay, so they're all back there in the real world, and Krakoa here does look very much used up. All those green flower pods are now just, you know, twisted, dried up brown stems. So I don't know how much they're leaving behind for all these regular mutants to farm tubers with. But I'm not quite sure what kind of a world this is anymore. Maybe we'll see it. Maybe we won't see much of it. One mutant who's very much still here in the White Hot Room is Hope. So 100% can't be Hope flying off of Pacific Krakoa in Rise. When Kafka, little moth boy, asks her, you know, why are you still here? She says, I have Messiah stuff to do. She doesn't say stuff, but right. It's just printed in those symbols that Tom King likes to look. We'll just say stuff. So now it is Phoenix time. Hope returns to Jean's funeral pyre, which is not lit yet. Just Jean lying there on top of a big old pile of sticks. And I guess some of these are the Krakoan sticks that had that whatever multiversal stuff from Prodigy imprinted in them. Jean, again, not quite alive, not quite dead. She's in whatever weird Phoenix-y state she gets into when she dies and she resurrects, kind of in the White Hot Room. Hope asks herself what fire could hurt Jean, and then answers her own question by saying, "Jean's," which I take to mean that Hope is borrowing some of Jean Grey's Phoenix firepower to light Jean Grey's funeral pyre. Again, mystical, it makes sense in a metaphysical kind of way. It burns up super quickly, and I think it works, mostly. Jean, we don't see her physically there, really. We see a silhouette in the fire, and whether that's just the body burning up or the return of a physical Jean Grey, we don't know yet. But a psychic message comes from Jean to Hope, saying, "Yeah, okay, I'm feeling better now. I'm more sensible, more in control of myself." But, Jean says, the Phoenix is scared and confused. Now, that seems awful dangerous to me. The Phoenix Force being scared and confused, that's asking for trouble. Jean asks Hope if, you know, how can I help the Phoenix? How can I make this work better? Hope says, "Yeah, I can help you out." And she does this, or gets ready to do this, by racking her favorite pistol, making the, you know, shick-shick sound as she does that. And I have no idea how this connects. We know, we've heard that this is a pistol that she made because it's her favorite. She composed out of individual molecules. But how does a physical handgun connect with helping the Phoenix feel better? That is very, very strange to me. I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah.
Any theories there, or just craziness?
This better not be a gun that can hurt the Phoenix, because, or kill the Phoenix, right, to allow it to fully resurrect. That would be really obnoxious. Like, I don't need a gun that does that.
Yeah, that'd be even worse than the gun that depowers mutants. That would be a gun you'd have to really put somewhere super, super safe. So we got to wrap this up now. What to make of it? As you might have guessed from some of the words I used earlier, all the mystical hand-wavy stuff, not my favorite thing. Part of why I'm not really into Phoenix stories. Phoenix is, by its nature, just not the kind of thing you would explain. And I like stories that have some kind of reasonable explanations. Even if they're fantastical, I want there to be some kind of internal logic, and internal logic really doesn't apply to the Phoenix. That's what we have to work with. Gillen's doing about as good a job as you can in just gesturing at the Phoenix, saying, "Yeah, I know it doesn't make sense. Let's kind of go with it."
Yeah, Phoenix stuff.
I do like some of the ritual qualities here, the funeral procession, the funeral pyre, the idea of using Jean's own Phoenix fire to light her own funeral pyre. I like that stuff. Even bringing back some of the Prodigy Macron crystal things. Nice touches. Makes us think that that miniseries was at least a little bit more important. I did love that scene with Exodus and Kafka. It adds in that little bit of, you know, reminding us that there's a ton of mutants here. We're really only following a tiny fraction that have these big cosmic powers that drive the story. But hey, let's not forget, it's really all about these regular people type mutants. And that was a very cool
scene. Yeah, I agree. I like that part.
Yeah, we learn that not everybody's going to get a happy ending here. Not everybody gets to go home, which gives this kind of magical, silly story a little bit more emotional weight. Good stuff. I did enjoy Luca Maresca's art. It's hard to read this right after the Arby Silva issue, because he's just so amazing. The art here is a little bit simpler, not quite as detailed, but it tells a story really well. I love that one scene with all those mutants going back to the real world. I loved how he depicted the aftermath of that, with Krakoa looking very unmagical and used up. It does an excellent job. I still need to know that other reason that Xavier joined Orcus, that Destiny teasing that and pulling it back, so infuriating, but really clever. That is the shoe I'm waiting to see drop. Again, really hard to give this issue a score, because it all depends on how it winds up. I might look back on this as being amazingly successful, all these weird little things click into place, but we're not there yet, so I can't give it credit for something that hasn't happened. I would give this an 8 out of 10. Just for the presence of Forget Me Not, I'm going to pop this up to an 8.1 out of 10. I'm just so happy to see him there. I think this made more sense than Rise, but still has confusing things that I hope are confusing on purpose, but hasn't been proven yet. How about you, Ruben?
Yeah, I'm gonna go a little more conservative and just say 7. But
okay,
it's a positive 7. This fills in a lot of the blanks in that last issue we read. Like, I feel like you had to read both of these, or you wouldn't. Like, it would just feel too rushed. It would feel more like what Duggan's doing. And so I appreciate that. I certainly love seeing like who's back and seeing a few pictures of them. And I always felt bad about how Forget Me Not died, right, to Nimrod. So it is kind of nice to see him get a resurrection. And he's a cool character, right? I actually think his power is really interesting and different. And so gives me hope that we'll see him again. I didn't want to see that character.
Yeah, I guess now. If I'm trying to score this as just a single issue, the fact that it's you can't read this on its own makes it hard to give it a really great score. So I can see why it you'd want to dig it for that. So, but we enjoyed it, and we're looking forward to what's coming up next.
I want more issues like this. I mean, just give me more issues like this, quality 7. I'll be happy, right, with a few excellent Spike issues, and it would be like the best comic you'd read forever. But
yeah, it really has the possibility. If it all works out in the end, you know, knock on my particle board desk, this could be really, really classic. So those were our books this week. Looking forward to next week, along with Wolverine number 48, because we're skipping it now. We're already almost at an hour 15, which is pretty long for us. Next week, we're going to talk about X-Men number 34, which is the last issue of that title before the big X-Men 700 or Uncanny 700 wrap-up. We're also going to look at Iron Man number 18 to see what Tony's up to. And, well, this coming Saturday, May 4th, is Free Comic Book Day. And it is extra important for us because we're going to get our very first little X story coming out under Tom Brevoort. I think I've said his name like 6 different ways, but I don't know how to say it. So the first story that's kind of kicking off that whole From the Ashes era, which we're told will be a Jubilee story written by Gail Simone, drawn by David Marquez, and that will be found in Marvel's Bloodhunt / X-Men Free Comic Book Day offering. So, Ruben, I expect you and I are going to talk about that a little bit next week, too. I have no idea if it's going to be just, you know, one page of, hey, the art looks cool, or if there will be any meat in there that we'll actually get to discuss.
Yeah, we'll see. It'll be interesting.
Have you looked at all at the Free Comic Book Day listings? Do you have any other ones you're looking forward to?
No, I should do that after this.
Well, there is one and call to your attention. It's another Marvel book. It is the Ultimate Universe / Spider-Man Free Comic Book Day, and that will be previewing the Ultimates comic that'll be written by Dennis Camp. So I'll certainly be reading that. That's all I have to say today. So, Ruben, we've had a lot to say already, but what do you think our fine listeners might do to keep themselves occupied until Free Comic Book Day?
Read more X-Men comics.